This podcast is brought to you by Nationwide. With higher life expectancy, it's important for clients to understand how longevity may impact their retirement income. Nationwide offers an easy way to help your clients estimate future health care and long-term care costs. The Nationwide Healthcare Cost Assessment Tool provides personalized estimates of Medicare premiums, deductibles, coinsurance, and out-of-pocket costs, as well as long-term care. Try the tool now at nationwidefinancial.com/LTC.
Welcome to the Retirement Repair Shop, where we discuss an array of challenges that can derail the best laid retirement plans. I'm your host, Mary Beth Franklin. Today, we're discussing one of the biggest fears of many retirees, a debilitating illness and how to pay for it. With me today is Tom West, a partner in the investment management and financial planning firm of Signature Estate and Investment Advisors in Vienna, Virginia. Tom has a robust financial planning practice that emphasizes cash flow in all stages of retirement, with an emphasis on planning for families facing the health-related challenges due to disability, illness, or the death of a loved one. As people live longer with terminal diseases, the costs associated with their care rise. The risk is not just there will not be enough money to provide for that care, but that a surviving spouse will be left alone and destitute. But there are strategies that can help families make the most of their resources, both now and in the future. So, Tom, welcome.
Welcome.
Give us an example of the type of client you typically work with and how you help them adapt their finances to care for a loved one.
Well, generally speaking, the clients that we serve, Mary Beth, fall into two categories. Families that are planning ahead for the possibility that they might have a transition with housing and healthcare down the road and want to establish a set of decisions before challenges might occur. But certainly a lot of the clients, and certainly what we're going to be talking about on your podcast today, are clients that are all of a sudden faced with new circumstances where their goals and their priorities that they had prior to a change in health really have been upended. That's a lot of what I serve in my practice.
Okay, give me an example. Someone has a sudden diagnosis, maybe a terminal illness or a debilitating illness. What do you do now? They come to you and say, help.
Sure. Well, I think the first thing that we need to establish with our client is a recognition that there are new priorities that are introduced that sometimes are hard to articulate when somebody is faced with the ambiguity of not knowing how long somebody's going to live or what kind of help that they might need. Where before, somebody might have priorities of leaving a good big legacy for the kids, or traveling, or gifting, or engaging in some personal growth culture-wise and whatnot. Now, all of a sudden, there are new priorities where the most important thing is for us to stay home no matter what, or the most important thing is for us to stay together even if we can't stay home, or the most important thing is to get the family together the last time. It's important to understand with the clients what kinds of things they're most hopeful for, what kinds of things they're most fearful of in the situation that they find themselves in, and recognize that there are new priorities that have to be included in the robust financial plan that we hope to serve them with.
Do you often find yourself serving as a reality check for their hopes and dreams? Like, yeah, that's great, but that's not going to happen.
Sometimes. I think that one of the things I've learned is the senior clients that I have a pretty wide range of full denial to very realistic sobriety with what their circumstances are. I would find that early on in the conversations, I'm trying to ascertain when I'm asking questions about what are you most hopeful for, I can discover pretty quickly whether they're accepting the situation that they're in, if they're fully aware of how circumstances have changed. Those are going to be some of the foundational building blocks that we use to establish a good decision-making process, how they're viewing their current situation.
And does that decision process depend on how much assets they have to start with, or are those decisions across the board regardless of how wealthy they are?
I'd probably say the process should be the same. And I think that let's review what the good fiduciary process really is. And this is the same. It builds from the prudent man rule. It builds from the CFP planning process. You always want to organize all your information first. You don't want to rush ahead to try to prescribe something without fully understanding what a clinical circumstance is, what a financial situation is. So that's true regardless of net worth and whatnot. What are all the facts? The second thing that you got to do are, what are the goals and what are the things that are important, which is why I was talking about things that you're most hopeful for. We then try to establish what is the range of options that you really have. And that, Mary Beth, is where maybe that reality check part of the conversation comes in. Sometimes people have to be calibrated with what their true set of choices might be. I think that after you establish your options, you got to pick one and you got to execute on it. And then you always have a monitoring function. How are things going? Is this plan going the way that we think it is? And then you start organizing and calibrating from there. That process is going to be true regardless of a family circumstance. And I think that's part of the reason it's the fiduciary standard, regardless, because it always makes sure that it goes in a circle and it makes some intuitive sense. It's the same approach, really, that doctors use from a diagnosis and prescription standpoint. Your points about what different techniques, what are the tactics that you use? Those probably do vary by wealth, but they also vary by family circumstance, by preference, and sometimes by what somebody's clinical prognosis might be. For example, if somebody has a terminal illness and the care that is being prescribed is mostly going to be designed to keep somebody comfortable and as dignified as possible through that process, that might have a very different financial implication than somebody that has early onset dementia in their 60s. And they might have a very different set of challenges that need to have sometimes unique financial solutions for.
I know you were quoted in a New York Times article a few years ago of one of your clients where the husband had been diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, which is a terrible, debilitating disease, and he and his wife wanted to stay together. And I thought some of your guidance was very interesting, that she was still working, and her initial reaction is, I should quit to take care of him. And then you were able to help her see another alternative. Can you talk about that?
Sure. In that particular case, it really had to do with getting a good look at what are the scenarios involved with taking care of a spouse, whether it's the spouse's role to earn. Is it the spouse's role to be the physical caregiver, to be the care manager? For those of us that have had a life circumstances of taking care of a loved one, you realize, certainly this is true of my family, that the job description is almost endless. In that particular client's case, there was a number of different balancing items. It did turn out that from a financial projection standpoint, it made more sense for her to continue to work. They had long-term care insurance in place, and her financial future had the highest likelihood of success if she was able to continue working during her high earning years, maximize contributions into Social Security, and to continue to make a little bit more savings into her own retirement plan, while the tax deductions associated with his care that were being paid out of some income were keeping their tax liability low.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because you and I have had this conversation in many different contexts. And you used to create a quiz for financial advisors using a scenario, I believe, of mom is going into a nursing home. Mm-hmm. And mom has five pots of assets. She's got a home. She has an IRA. She has cash. She has stocks and she has bonds. And as I believe you challenged the financial advisors that, okay, the first month bill is coming due, what pots of money do you use to pay for it? And logically, you would say cash.
Everybody raise their hands with cash.
What happens next?
Well, that's what's interesting is if you poll, I do this both with consumers and with financial advisors, if in this play scenario, we exhaust all the cash and what remains are bonds, appreciated stocks, home equity, and retirement, you'll ask, well, what happens next? And all sorts of different hands go out. And then I'll go through each of them. And the only one that nobody likes is home equity. But there sometimes is a pretty even distribution between retirement accounts and stocks and bonds. And this is the logic that people use. Well, stocks sometimes get the treatment of, this is my opportunity to rebalance all those crummy stocks in the portfolio that I never got around to. Like, all right, maybe. Bonds, well, sometimes treasuries can be treated like cash, and this is a low interest rate environment. Like, well, maybe. I mean, IRAs, interestingly enough, It's a bias about deferring taxation on distribution that most of the time causes IRAs to be considered almost at the end of the queue. And as we've discussed a number of different times, the answer on what happens after a lot of times cash makes sense has specifically to do with how much are they going to be having at the end of the year in projected itemized medical expense deductions. And even after 2017, where the standard deduction raised as high as it was, most of the families that are paying $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 in cost of care well exceed that standard deduction, and sometimes for the first time are looking at a significant tax deduction that they never had in previous chapters of their life. The best practice for a financial advisor is to account for the reality that these are oftentimes deductible expenses. There's an IRS publication 72 that lists them all out, just to be sure. But one of the things that I think is critically important as it relates to which bucket of money, sometimes it makes sense to accelerate distributions out of the IRA, even beyond the required minimum distribution that many advisors and consumers are aware that they have to take after age 70 and a half.
Because the shorthand of that is normally when you take a distribution from an IRA, it's fully taxable at your ordinary income tax rate.
Right.
But if you're medical expenses are so big, the deductions could literally wipe out your tax bill. So when you take money out of the IRA, suddenly it's tax-free.
Right. And I'm going to be, we're recording this at the Retirement Income Summit, and probably in about an hour, I'll be giving a presentation on a case study. And in my case study, it ends up that I was talking about a client that I engaged at the end of the year. And they had already accumulated a lot of these tax deductions, but they were continuing to withhold taxes from their pension and from the IRA distribution that they had previously. It was important to make sure that we accelerated those distributions because they had already withheld sufficient taxes to take even more than they would have otherwise. The reason I mentioned this at the end of the year, you can't carry forward these Schedule A deductions.
Exactly.
It's hugely important for advisors and consumers to know at that last quarter of the year to make sure you do a deduction check so that you have a potential tax benefit for all of these medical expenses. Come January 1, you should also be doing a calculation to see if somebody's alive and they have a requisite amount of care that you know is going to be always prescribed due to a chronic illness, you should be able to do a rolling calculation to see if January or February or March goes by, do you have an ongoing tax liability, and make some smart withholding decisions right at the beginning of the year then. I always like to tell clients and advisors that paying for long-term care, this is an income problem. It's not an asset problem, which is why I like it with the Retirement Income Summit that I'm speaking at. It's an income problem. And if you're withholding taxes from your income that you don't owe because you have enough deductions, well, that's just an easy way for you to make sure you have the most income at hand in the moment.
Right. That's a great point. You know, earlier I recorded a podcast on another topic. I was dealing with widows, and my expert there, Kathleen Real, was talking about the widow's brain, how you're dealing with this trauma, and basically your brain goes to mush, and it's so hard to make executive function decisions, like financial decisions. I'm sure it's a similar situation with ongoing caregiving for a terminally ill or severely impaired spouse or other loved one.
Sure. And I'll have the pleasure of presenting with Kathleen and at the summit. I think one area that both widows and widowers can find themselves in that's in common with caregivers is what are the implications of grief and stress? And there's all sorts of brain science that shows that executive function, you know, the ability to make decisions among a bunch of choices, there is some correlation with age, but I think that that idea of widow's brain or caregiving fog, there are a number of different euphemisms for them. They're also sometimes impacted by stress, by lack of sleep, by irregular meals. All of these things can sometimes impede what would otherwise be effective decision-making, sometimes for years. And the other piece, too, is financial advisors. We've got to recognize what is in our control and what isn't in our control. You can't snap your fingers and shake somebody out of this fog that they might be in. What the most important thing is to try to understand with the client What are the things that they're most hopeful for? What are the things that they're most afraid of? And engage them in the decision-making that best improves the probability of being able to pay for those things. I always find that the use of stories, that the use of getting some past history to be able to engage the client in a way that can show that the new circumstance that they're in is really just another chapter in the same book that they've always had. And how can this set of decisions just feel a little bit more like a continuation of ways that you've always approached challenges, as compared to feeling like the rug's been totally pulled out from under you and you don't have a really good footing?
Well, most financial advisors have experience with retirement planning as part of the normal continuum. What happens, and let's talk two different circumstances. Suddenly there's maybe a car accident, mm-hmm. and the breadwinner is now incapacitated. How does an advisor deal with that family, with suddenly their goals and their needs and perhaps their income sources have changed?
I think the first thing that you have to do is you have to see what decisions need to be made immediately and what decisions can be responsibly deferred while people sort themselves out. I think the immediate things have to do with, are there short-term liquidity needs for things like mortgage payments or taxes or things like that? And advisors are well served by calculating out liquidity needs through a period of time that a family might be able to get themselves their feet underneath them. The second thing is, in the event that there is a sudden change like that, what insurances might be available? You certainly want to review if, in your example, somebody is working, are there short or long-term disability coverages that they might have through a plan at work? Are there any private plans? And are there any other supports, perhaps family support, that might not be immediately evident if the advisor is only looking at somebody's tax return and balance sheet? So you want to do a full look at what are all the different resources that might be brought to bear that would define some of the set of options. I think past that, I think we got to go back to that process that we were talking about. After organizing all your information, what are the set of options that the family's looking at? And a lot of this I've learned is going to be very dependent on what the clinical, what the therapeutic set of diagnoses and prescriptions might be. If somebody needs to be in long-term rehab for a while, is this going to be something that's covered by health insurance? Is this going to be something that's going to be fully done out of pocket? Are you going to be potentially eligible for Social Security disability? How do all those things work? That's part of the fact pattern that you need to establish when you're refining the sets of options. It's important to do all that first before, as an advisor, jumping into a set of choices that might be a little bit premature. I honestly think that that's the single biggest mistake that advisors and consumers make, is making decisions too quick before they have the entire fact pattern established. I've seen families move. I've seen families quit their job before getting all of their facts in front of them. And we also always want to appreciate, when there's a violent change like that that we're talking about with the family, sometimes it feels like you have to do something as an expression of love, as an expression of support. Like, I can't just be static and just wait.
I have to do something.
And this is, this is my role as a spouse or a child or a parent. Like, I have to do something. It isn't always the case that action is the best first step. Sometimes it's, let's wait until the dust settles a little bit to see what this really might look like. The only other thing that I would offer in your short-term urgent example is, let's remember, most people, their health and their independence, they don't keep changing violently, forever. Meaning, somebody doesn't go from independent to fully dependent to back to independent to fully dependent. It's not like market volatility. Past a period of transition, there's usually plateaus that start coming, that maybe you have to be looking at some prescriptions where there's a rehab after a stroke or an injury that's a slow grind back, or maybe there's a longer term disability where there really isn't any improvement, like some brain trauma. Or again, if there's a third path, maybe it's a gradual decline. Getting an idea on what the prognosis is for the particular circumstance really informs some of the sets of options that you build out with the client. And that in turn is going to, what I think, drive the fiduciary recommendations on what an advisor is going to be recommending with money, with equity in the house, with do you continue to work, and so on.
Well, it's interesting that you mention the house, because a lot of the things you're talking about are not in the typical financial advisor's wheelhouse to start with. You know, disability, maybe Medicare, not so much for some people. You mentioned housing. A lot of times, the person who's ill or infirmed might have to move to a facility. How do we pay for this? What happens to the family left behind? How do you, as an advisor, become an expert in housing issues, and how does that fit into the financial plan?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it's an advisor's responsibility to be fully trained on all of the different elements of how the wealth in home equity can be used to serve expenses. So that would include, do you take out a loan on the house? Do you restructure an existing mortgage? Does it make sense to do a home equity line? How does a reverse mortgage, depending on the age, make sense or not make sense? I think that the advisor and consumers are appropriately served by uncoupling the home as or a house as a home and a place of shelter where I got to live, and what are the implications of the wealth that has accumulated in the equity in the home, and then sometimes the cash flow responsibilities associated with an ongoing mortgage payment. My particular technique is we just illustrate what happens if you don't live in your house. What happens if you rent? What happens if, in your example, somebody lives in an apartment and in a rehab facility? I always think that it is grounding for clients to actually see how all of these scenarios might play out. And that's how I kind of define some of these different options. I think when you were asking earlier, how do you make sure that clients are engaged? If they can understand all of the implications of these scenarios that we build out, I'm pretty sure that they're engaged. It's one thing to not have a very specific understanding of what it means to sell your house and to rent a place while a spouse is in a rehab. And it's another thing to actually see it on a piece of paper and see whether you can afford it or not, or are you going to run out of money at a certain period of time. That's a lot more actionable when you actually see it all in a situation like that. But I like the question, because I believe that home equity, there's always a bias that that's the last thing to go and it's untouchable, and it's that's not the best use of the wealth all the time that can be established in home equity.
Well, we're certainly seeing more in overall financial planning, looking at the home as perhaps the largest chunk of wealth that a lot of clients have. Right. And how do we divorce the emotional aspect of it's my home, it's where I raise my children, versus it's an asset that I could tap to make sure I have a secure retirement?
You know, I think at its core, what really good advisors, financial advisors, tax, legal advisors, what they illustrate for clients are trade-offs. And sometimes those emotions that we established with home, this is a place that I grew up, this is a place that I raised my kids and so on, getting rid of that would break my heart, but also look at these new priorities. And sometimes it's a matter of coaching people through difficult choices. That's what we're paid to do.
Tom, this has been a fascinating discussion. Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I think that when, you know, sometimes I get asked, how do you plan ahead? I think that you have to make sure that you account for projecting medical expenses and long-term care expenses as a certainty in retirement. I don't believe that people either do or don't need long-term care. I think that they are going to need some care, and different people need different amounts. Make sure that that's part of your budget way before you retire if you can. That's probably the best parting thought that I can give.
Tom, this has been great. Thank you so much, Tom West, for joining us here today on the Retirement Repair Shop.
You're welcome. Thanks.
There is no one-size-fits-all when it comes to financial planning for disability and long-term illness. Each diagnosis has a different set of next steps. As an advisor, you can help families take a step back to think and to prioritize. More importantly, you can't minimize how the stress of caregiving can impede financial decision-making. As Tom West noted in this interview, the best advice is to slow down. Action is not always the best first step. And Tom also pointed out that a long-term care plan is not a, quote, nice to have, but a, quote, need to have for all of your clients. Because the ultimate role of an advisor is to coach people through some of their toughest moments. If you have a story you'd like to share about a retirement hurdle you're facing, or if you have a question that you'd like to ask of one of our experts, contact us here at the Retirement Repair Shop. That's investmentnews.com/repair shop.
This podcast is brought to you by Nationwide. Clients are living longer in retirement, so it's important to take a long-term approach to retirement income, especially when it comes to Social Security. The Nationwide Social Security 360 Analyzer can enable you to identify optimal filing strategies, generate personalized reports, and show clients how Social Security fits into the retirement income picture. Test drive the tool now at nationwidefinancial.com/360.